And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Let's turn back the clock. We're going to go back to Thursday, June 24th of 2021. The scene is the Champlain Tower South, located in Surfside, Florida.
Just north of Miami Beach, after a condominium building partially collapsed early Thursday morning.
We had a 12-story, 136-unit apartment complex that had sustained a partial collapse. The northeast corridor of the apartment had collapsed, approximately 55 apartment units.
The Miami-Dade Fire Rescue says more than 80 units were sent to the scene.
They are in search and rescue mode. They are trying to identify survivors. I know they have made contact with some, and they're doing everything they can to save lives.
First responders rescuing a young man from the rubble using a bucket to take people off their balconies.
We still have people standing upstairs that don't need to be evacuated.
Barry Cohen thought it was a thunderstorm.
We opened up the door from our apartment, and there was a huge pile of rubble and dust. When we got to the bottom of the stairs, we couldn't open the door because the steel had bent in the door.
The collapse sent a cloud of debris throughout the neighborhood. Cars as far as two blocks away coated with dust.
There's a third of the entire building that you cannot see from the street, but it's completely gone in the back towards the beach side.
Wow. Can you imagine? Most of us, fortunately, can't. However, my first guest tonight, sadly, is more than aware of not only the events of that fateful night in June of 2021, but the impact on his family. It is certainly challenging to have your heart broken, your confidence shattered, and your faith tested to the limits, feeling as if your world has collapsed. But in that process, as he argues in a new book, your spirit doesn't have to. Mike Noriega joins us. He's author of a new book soon to be released called Uncollapsible Soul. How do you endure a broken heart without crushing your spirit? Newly released by Genesis Publishing. And Mike, I know that you have a very intimate connection to the events of June of 2021. I understand your grandmother perished in the collapse, and our condolences. Thank you so much for being with us today to share your story. Why talk about this, given how frightful the scene is, and of course played over and over and over again ad nauseum on television in the days and weeks following this event? Why did you feel it was important to go public with your family's tragedy?
Well, thank you so much for having me today. It really is an honor, because I really believe that there is hope through heartbreak. My grandmother and I had a very close relationship, because after I was born, my aunt, her daughter, was killed in a car accident about 6 months later. And all that love and adoration and affection that she had for her daughter, she just poured it into me. And up to my 37 years of life at that time when the collapse happened, my grandmother told me, "You saved my life. You saved my life." And I never really understood what that meant until my grandmother was gone. And the reason is because through this whole process, one of the things that has so impacted me is that my grandmother, she lived her life from a place of an overflow of God's love that affected everyone around her. And so one of my favorite quotes that encapsulates her life is by Mark Batterson from Chase the Lion. He says that an inheritance is what we leave behind for someone, but a legacy is what we leave behind in someone. I wanted other people to be touched by my grandmother's life, not because of how she died, but because of how she lived. Otherwise, this whole tragedy and incident was just in vain. But as time went on, initially it was just me and my family's pain and dealing with our trauma. And about 10 months after the collapse, I was added on to a WhatsApp chat with all of the Surfside families that lost somebody. And three of the people on that chat actually were survivors that went down in the collapse and were pulled out of the rubble alive and survived. And from all of that, as I started to get to know these other families, it had such a profound impact on my life, because as I listened to their stories, I was reliving the same experience but through a different perspective. And there was just so much pain and so much anguish. And so it was so much bigger than me and my family and the loss that we went through. And it's really opened up my soul to how in this world that collapses happen all around us, and there's nothing we can do about it. But what we can control is preventing a collapse from within us.
Well, that's such a valid point that you make, Mike, because whether you're talking about the horrifying, tragic collapse of an occupied building, shattering the night and leaving so much devastation behind, or the collapsing of a marriage relationship, or perhaps a relationship with a son or a daughter that's dealing with substance abuse. I mean, there are so many examples of the way in which the order of our lives can suddenly collapse. Maybe it's the diagnosis of cancer that's inoperable, and suddenly everything that you've known, everything that you've trusted, is just literally completely gone and torn out from underneath you. And so learning how to deal with the collapses that inevitably happen in life, and yet, as you say in the subtitle of your book, learning to endure a broken heart without crushing your spirit, I think is a very important lesson for all of us. Give me your sense first, not to belabor the point in the events of Thursday, June 24th, but when did you first learn of this? When did your family first learn of the collapse?
So my father worked with the City of Miami Beach Police Department for almost 30 years, and he retired as the chief of police, and he moved on to a smaller town called North Bay Village that is in Miami, not too far from Surfside. And so the way we initially found out about it was a family friend, because my grandmother lived in that building for 20 years, a family friend that was in the building that did not collapse, because it was a partial collapse. About a third of the building just disintegrated in the middle of the night. But in the tower that didn't collapse, there was this woman that just called my father and woke him up in the middle of the night in a state of hysterics. And all she could say was, "The building is gone, the building is gone." And my father just popped out of bed and flew down to Surfside. And I got a phone call not too long after from my mother, and she said, "Hey, your father just got this phone call. Your brother is coming to pick me up, and then we're coming to pick you up, and we're heading to Surfside." Now, this was about 1:30 in the morning. So I'm thinking to myself, what could have happened that we'd be going to Surfside in the middle of the night? And I called the Surfside Police Department there on the spot, and they could give me very little information. But I asked them, I said, "Look, it's the middle of the night. Maybe you can't tell me what happened, but should I be going down there?" And they said, "Yes, absolutely. I would highly advise you get down there." And so my curiosity peaked. And when we arrived, nothing could have prepared me for it. Nothing could have prepared anybody for it. You know, part of the grief cycle is denial, because it's almost like a defense mechanism that allows you to absorb trauma in a slow process. And it took me about an hour to realize that this wasn't a bad dream that I wasn't going to wake up from, that this was not a planned demolition in the middle of the night that my grandmother forgot to tell me about. This wasn't a movie set, that it was real.
You knew the building. You had visited the building many times, and so when you looked at the building or the part that remained juxtaposed to the other two sections that had collapsed, you, I would imagine, Mike, knew instantly that the part that was impacted was one of the units where your grandmother lived?
Well, yeah, because the building was 12 stories high, and the first half of the building, the first five or six stories, was in the parking garage. And everything you could see, all of the rubble, was the top half of the building. My grandmother lived on the sixth floor, so she was right in the middle of the collapse.
Wow.
And we could see her balcony, like her mangled balcony with her furniture that we sat in so many times, right there. And trying to comprehend that she was somewhere underneath there was just something that was so horrific. I'll never forget that my father, for probably a couple hours, just started calling her cell phone over and over and over. Not because he expected her to pick it up, but because if her cell phone survived, perhaps she could have survived. He just wanted to hear a vibration. He just wanted to hear a noise. And so what we were searching for was hope. And we just ended up finding it in a different way.
In the days, and they turned, of course, into hours, turned into days, turned into well over a week. Clearly, over that period of time, while there were one or two people that were rescued, there was a diminishing sense of hope that anybody would be able to survive. I mean, just looking at the enormity of 12 stories pancaked in the way they were, reduced to virtually a pile of rubble. I know there was even hope that maybe some people in the upper floors might have been spared. It's got to shake one's sense of not only hope to the very core, but as well as all of the why God questions. And I want to come to that as our conversation continues. Mike Noriega is with us today. Mike has written a new book soon to be released called Uncollapsible Soul, How to Endure a Broken Heart Without Crushing Your Spirit. His grandmother, as we've mentioned, was one of the tragic victims of the Champlain Tower South collapse that happened in Surfside, Florida, back in June of 2021. We'll take a brief time out, come back to more of our discussion with Mike Noriega as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
All right, welcome back to the conversation. Mike Noriega's with us tonight. He's author of Uncollapsible Soul, How Do You Endure a Broken Heart Without Crushing Your Spirit? Soon to be released by Genesis Publishing. Mike, we appreciate you sharing in such a candid way your family's experience and also what was going on in your own heart and mind. And of course, when these kinds of events happen, they are so enormous, so overwhelming, they're so out of our sort of emotional, spiritual, intellectual frame of reference, we just can't imagine that this has happened. And denial, of course, is a frequent early on coping mechanism, and then moving into other feelings, including anger and a sense of hopelessness. And I'm curious, in your own experience, how fast was the shift from hoping that there would be better news to beginning to realize that a miracle was likely not going to happen, and then dealing with the struggle of all of the why God, what if kinds of questions?
I would say probably within the first couple days. I mean, she was the 12th person found on the sixth day, but I would say after a couple days, we were really losing hope. We hoped that she was alive from the get-go, but we knew that the odds were very much so against it. And the greatest thing that I could tell you is my book really addresses two things. It addresses the fake side of our hearts, and it addresses the healing side of our hearts. On the faith front, I would say that the thing that inspired the book was really Psalm 34:18. That verse was everywhere during that time of my life. But in January of 2022, I heard someone say it, and it was like the Holy Spirit just spoke it to my heart in a fresh new way that I never understood it. It says that the Lord is near to the brokenhearted, and he rescues those that are crushed in spirit. Why is the Lord near to those that are brokenhearted, but he wants to rescue those that are crushed in spirit? If he wants to rescue you from one, but not necessarily the other, that must mean that those two things are different. And what I learned is that a broken heart is something that we cannot avoid in this life. That even Jesus was not able to escape sorrow. That there's always going to be a grief process that we're going to have to go through, because that's part of life, that we all go through different losses. But a crushed spirit, oof, that's something entirely different. That's where you lose your faith, your hope, and your purpose. That's like a bird without wings or a well without water, where you feel like you just exist without purpose or hope. What I learned 10 years prior, and I'm going to give you guys a plot twist to my book here, but what really encouraged me to write this book and teach me this lesson was that I had actually gone through a divorce 10 years prior that really crushed my spirit, because I believed that God was going to save my marriage. And when he didn't, man, it was like, God, I was faithful in my marriage to get cheated on and then lose my wife? Your way doesn't work. But the key to a crushed spirit is when you have your faith built on the wrong foundation. In other words, when your faith is attached to an outcome rather than to Jesus, that is what leads to a crushed spirit. Because our theology is wrong if it's attached to an outcome. Because we have to look at Jesus, because Jesus was perfect. He had full authority of heaven. He was God in the flesh. But he went through betrayal and pain and loss and torture. And there is nothing that we go through that he himself did not go through first. So it's easy to ask, why, God, why did you allow this? But I think a huge perspective shift that will really alter how we look at the lens of faith, or through the lens of faith, is how could Jesus be perfect and yet he didn't escape any of these things? And that's why he is near to our broken heart, because he is the God of not sympathy, he is the God of empathy, that he has felt everything that we feel. So when we go to God, that connection happens, intimacy happens when someone understands and feels what we feel, and that is the God that we serve. So that's what led to me writing on the faith side of this book. But then the other side of it is the healing side. And that's so important, because there's a lie that's taught in culture that all things heal with time. And that is just not true. Maybe all things get buried with time, but eventually, if you don't face your past will face you. Something that a lot of people don't know is that a byproduct of suffering is passion. Like, for example, the movie The Passion of the Christ, why do they call it that? Well, how do you know if you're passionate about something? Because you're willing to suffer for it. If you're not willing to suffer for it, then by default, you're not passionate about it. Now, passion is neutral, meaning if you go down the road of passion, there's a fork in the road that you'll eventually hit. And that fork can lead to resentment. So if you become passionate about your anger and your hate and your rage, what you're doing is you're becoming passionate about resentment, and that will manifest in your life through bitterness. But if you allow that passion to go towards healing, towards restoration, well, the byproduct of that is going to be the fruits of the Spirit and joy in your life. But healing has to be intentional, and that's why through my book, attached to the stories of very specific families that either survived the collapse, or in some cases, like my grandmother, those that passed away, I attach a step to healing that I actually went through, that I learned through each family member's life that I write about.
Looking back over not just the events of that night, but then to some degree, reliving aspects of this as you poured out your heart in the pages of Uncollapsible Soul, as you conduct these kinds of conversations, what's the big takeaway for you personally in all this?
For me personally, it's that in God's economy, nothing is ever wasted. That my life verse in all seasons is Romans 8:28, that God works all things for the good of those that love him and are called according to his purpose. It doesn't mean that all things that happen are good. But whether it's a bad situation, he's going to work it for your good. And if it's a good situation, he's going to work it for your good. The hard part is the in-between. And that's why hope is so essential. So for me, I cannot allow this tragedy to have happened without allowing God's story for his glory to come through so that other people can find healing in the midst of their collapse.
And undoubtedly many people, certainly those families that were impacted, 98 souls lost on that day. There's often been, and we've heard much of this in the news, that they really won't find closure until they find an answer as to why. It sounds to me as if there are degrees of which trying to really come to an answer is just going to be mere speculation on the part of architects and people in the building sciences and so forth. But it sounds to me, Mike, as if you've already found your answer. You've found your answer in the comfort that you've received from God's word and in your faith and trusting him, as you quote aptly from Romans, that all things work together for good to those that love the Lord and are are called according to his purposes. Final question for you, as you look back on this experience in your life and as you endeavor to share your experience to help others understand more about how they don't have to allow their entire lives to collapse when events around them seem as if they're going to crush them, what's the main thing that you want readers to take away from your book?
It's that what happened to you isn't to define you. It's more so that it's to refine you.
Ah.
That you are not your pain, that you are not your past, that you're not your mistake, that your identity is not attached to that. And, you know, there's this, you kind of just touched on it right now about, you know, there's going to be speculation behind, you know, why the building collapsed. You know, for me, the reason, part of the reason I wrote this book is also, you know, there's that verse that says, what is it to gain the world but lose your soul? Well, what is it to prevent another collapse from happening when the collapses within us are consuming us?
Mm.
In other words, we should build better around us. Absolutely. That shouldn't have happened. That collapse should never happen again. Nobody should ever have to experience that. But all we truly have control over is the collapses within us. And I believe that God has made our souls to be uncollapsible. But what happened in the collapse is that ultimately it was a weak foundation that gave out. And it's so symbolic of what happens in our lives when our lives are built on the wrong foundation.
Yeah, we're reminded and exhorted in Scripture to build our lives on solid rock and not on shifting sand. Mike, I sure appreciate your candor, your insights, sharing not only the pain of your tragedy, but most importantly, the lessons that you've walked away from. Invaluable lessons that I think are apropos for all of us as we deal with the collapse of different parts of our lives all the time. The book, Uncollapsible Soul, How Do You Endure a Broken Heart Without Crushing Your Spirit? Released by Genesis Publishing. It'll be out in stores within the next week or so, and you can get pre-order information by going online to uncollapsiblesoul.com. That's uncollapsiblesoul.com. Our thanks to author Mike Noriega, who tragically lost his own grandmother in the collapse of Champlain Towers South in Surfside, Florida. And thank you for demonstrating to all of us that with that firm foundation in your own life, Mike, you might be shaken, but your faith certainly has not collapsed. Thank you again to Mike Noriega.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
You've undoubtedly been seeing all the excitement related to the film Sound of Freedom. Just before coming on the air today, I read about a nationwide sting operation that has netted something like 122 some odd perpetrators who have been responsible for pulling people into sex trafficking. It is a plague that is impacting all of America, as severe as the issue related to illicit drug use. And I know it's easy to say, well, you know, it's the guys that's selling them. Well, you know what? If nobody was buying, they would have nobody to sell to, and they'd have to go find some other way to make money. So it is at the very core a moral issue, but as we attempt to try to target and address the moral side of the equation, there is a real human side of the equation, and that is that human beings in 2023 being trafficked as if they are just chattel, they're just simply property, and being exploited on sexual grounds for financial gain. Haley McNamara is Vice President of Strategy and Communications with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. Haley, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today. Certainly this new film, The Sound of Freedom, shining a big light on this topic, and a topic that continues to be problematic in so many communities across the nation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And you're exactly right. You know, this film addresses really important topics of child sex trafficking, and while the film largely focuses on the way that this happens internationally, it's very much an issue close to home that's happening all around our own country as well.
Well, exactly so. And as I allude to, you know, a lot of people think that, well, a lot of these issues begin overseas. People are being, you know, smuggled into the country. Drugs are being smuggled in. But the consumer is right here. And it's indicative of an extreme degree, in my opinion, of moral decay within our country. And as I say, while we would like to hope to be able to address that side of the equation as quickly as possible, there is a real issue here in relationship to intervention as quickly as possible for these individuals. And people need to understand it impacts women and men, and it impacts young children. Sometimes they're kidnapped. Oftentimes they have a spat at home, so they become runaways. Suddenly they're on the streets. And there's even cases where those responsible for the exploitation are known individuals. In fact, that happens more often than I think most people realize, Haley.
Yeah, you're completely right. You know, there's actually a stat that an estimated 82% of child sex crimes, so those are all sex crimes, but that include sex trafficking, begin with contact on social media platforms. Mm. You know, the online grooming of children for sexual exploitation is really significant. And like you said, sometimes even people close to the family who ingratiate themselves to the family. So this is a trusted friend or family member or teacher or, you know, even member of a religious community can unfortunately begin grooming and exploiting people.
And we'll hear things like, well, you know, why would anybody choose a life like that? What makes them think that that's a, you know, a respectable or reliable way to make a living? But I think we need to be very clear here that I would imagine the overwhelming abundance of individuals who find themselves on the victimization side of human trafficking, that they seldom, if ever, choose this, that they are either manipulated into it, coerced into it, or quite frankly, outright in the truest form of trafficking and sex slavery, threatened into it, either at the point of a gun or through drug manipulation, other means by which they essentially force a person into this lifestyle. And then once they get caught up into it, it's pretty difficult to get out, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, sex trafficking is really any kind of commercial sex act that's induced by force, fraud, or coercion. And people often think of force like the movie Taken, like kidnapping or being held physically against your will, which unfortunately does happen. But especially in America, one of the primary tactics for sex trafficking is psychological coercion, grooming, gaining trust, maybe sometimes blackmailing or extorting someone, threatening them, and escalating that abuse to the point of sex trafficking. So it might not look like someone who is waving their hands in the air calling for help, but they could be held in psychological chains, and that's a really common tactic in the U.S.
There was a time here in San Francisco, we had a DA, district attorney, by the name of Terrence Hallinan, that was rapidly moving towards trying to force the hand of the Board of Supervisors to essentially create decriminalized zones in San Francisco that would allow for free trade in prostitution. The argument went that, well, it's, quote unquote, two consenting adults. It is a, quote unquote, victimless crime. And rather than jailing women or men that are sex workers and punishing them, that we just need to simply create areas where they can ply their trade without the threat of having to deal with the vice squad, essentially. I was shocked when he first promoted this notion many, many years ago. Thankfully, he's not been our DA in a very long time, probably one of the worst in the city of San Francisco. But this notion of this being consenting adults and a victimless crime, offer some feedback on that, would you please?
Yes, I'm glad you're raising this, because this is a really serious, there's a really serious movement that's going state by state, like you said, trying to fully decriminalize prostitution. And people don't realize what that means is fully decriminalizing pimps and brothel keepers and sex buyers. And there have been studies on the effects of full decriminalization and legalization in other countries, and they find that sex trafficking skyrockets in countries and areas that do this. And a big reason why is, like you were talking about earlier, it's the demand. If we think about this as a marketplace, when something becomes legal, more people are interested in buying it. Unfortunately, you've seen that happen in other countries like New Zealand and Germany and others, where the sex trade explodes. And actually, there have been some surveys of sex traffickers who all say that they would love full decriminalization because it would make their job so much easier, because police wouldn't have the impetus to begin investigating cases. And I would also add on, like you mentioned, the vast majority of people who are engaging in selling sex are not there by choice. Either they're sex trafficked by force, fraud, or coercion, or they're there out of true desperation. Maybe someone who doesn't know how to put food on the table for their children, is addicted to drugs, has been sexually exploited as a child, and then internalizes that this is a way for them to continue to be sexually exploited as an adult but make money. And we see that there's extreme psychological and physical trauma that happens to anyone who is being bought for sex. So this is a really troubling issue, and it's something that our organization is at the ready. You know, in different states, we try to bring forward some of this research and also survivors to speak about the reality of those policies.
Yeah, and when we speak of a victimless crime, there are a few crimes, if any, that exist that are truly victimless. There's always something being taken from someone. In this case, it is innocence, it is freedom, it is the right to choose, and all of that. And I would imagine, as much as we think that this is largely all at the hands of organized crime, the mafia is involved, whatever the case might be, but there are plenty of people that get involved in this that perhaps do so, how should we say, less formally, but engage in the behavior nevertheless. I mean, for example, a boyfriend who gets upset with a girlfriend and coerces her because they need money into essentially engaging in prostitution, and then might either use embarrassment, information, other forms of threats, up to and including even getting a woman hooked on drugs as a means of basically gaining control or power over them to manipulate them into the sex trade. And it's form of business, so to speak, where you never run out of product. I mean, it's not like buying and selling goods. You can victimize an individual over and over and over again. And to that degree, where it's somebody that they know that might even be a boyfriend, probably happens more frequently than many realize.
Absolutely. And another layer there that is happening increasingly is using explicit photos of someone or videos in order to blackmail or extort them into sex trafficking. And that's very often done by a romantic partner or a sex trafficker posing as a romantic partner. Often part of the grooming process is that the trafficker makes the victim believe that they're in a loving relationship, and they just slowly turn up the dial of abuse, similar to what we know happens in domestic violence relationships. So this spread of technology and the iPhone, very often people will use images of a person to extort them to do things that they don't want to do, and sometimes even post recorded instances of sex trafficking onto pornography platforms as well in order to get another stream of revenue. So we see that this is something that it's so easy to be facilitated by technology, and absolutely can happen in the context of what someone thinks is a relationship.
Visiting today with Haley McNamara, Vice President of Strategy and Communications for the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. We've talked about some of the behavior, how some of it happens. When we come back, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into what we can do to recognize it and to intervene. I'm Craig Roberts. This edition of Lifeline continues right after this.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
We're talking about the topic of sex trafficking. And certainly the new film, The Sound of Freedom, is helping to shine a light more so on that topic. And, you know, this is, I realize, not polite conversation. You don't strike up this over, dinner with friends and family on a Saturday evening. But there are degrees to which I think we need to be talking about this, because it's happening all around us. If you think it's only in the seedy areas of the Tenderloin of San Francisco, or when the Super Bowl game is in town at the Levi Stadium in Santa Clara, I got news for you. It goes on all the time, and it's not just people who engage in this behavior that are kidnapping. It's not just boyfriends, but even cases of parents that have forced their children into sex trafficking, largely because they're trying to get money. So the big question becomes, if we can all agree that this is not a victimless crime, How do we go about not only raising awareness, but doing what can be done to put a stop to it? Certainly, enforcement of laws and stricter laws, stricter penalties, become exceedingly important. But when somebody's been pulled into this kind of lifestyle, it's very difficult oftentimes for them to break free because of the kind of stranglehold that the pimp will have on them. So how do you address these issues? And most importantly, what we can do in order to reduce the number of incidents. We continue our visit with Haley McNamara. And Haley, toward that end, again, this may be something that people think, well, it only happens in the bad neighborhoods. But that isn't true, is it?
No, this is absolutely something that happens in nearly every community in America, unfortunately, to some extent or another. It's very much close to home. So I think there's a number of things that we can do, luckily. One of the first things I would say is to learn some of the signs of sex trafficking and know that there is a national human trafficking hotline, which you can make reports to. Some of these signs, it might be really anyone under the age of 18 involved in commercial sex or sex in exchange for anything of value is by legal definition a victim of sex trafficking. But there are other signs as well, such as even adults or children living with an employer. If you maybe are unable to speak to an individual alone, sometimes you can get a gut feeling of someone seems fearful. If you know if an employer or someone else is holding their passport or identity documents. But I would say one that's really relevant to the average person going about their lives is if you know a friend, family, coworker, or student who's newly showered with gifts or money or becomes quickly involved in a fast-moving romantic relationship, especially if there's any difference in age or financial status, any large difference in that kind of relationship. And I would add on to that, if you know any person, and again, especially children, but adults as well, that has a quick kind of whirlwind romance with someone who they know primarily from social media. So these two things are some key ways that traffickers will begin to groom people in the United States. So I would keep an eye out for those kinds of warning signs in your own relationships.
And I'm curious, is law enforcement beginning to, rethink their approach to this? Because historically, much of the emphasis was placed on the pimps and the sex workers feeling as if, well, they're choosing to do this, they're engaging in the behavior, we're going to charge them with solicitation. That seems to wholly ignore the kind of forceful influence that's oftentimes operating behind the scenes.
Right, and we are really pushing for law enforcement to put more emphasis on the sex buyers. At the end of the day, sex buyers really are the root cause of sex trafficking. If no one was willing to pay for sexual access to exploited people, sex traffickers would have no reason to do what they do. So we do have actions on our website where people can ask your state legislators to increase accountability for sex buyers in order to help prevent sex trafficking. That's something that we advocate for, both increasing the penalties, but also we do have good laws on the books in most states, and we just need law enforcement to prioritize that.
Give me your sense in terms of how widespread this might be, because I've got to believe that there are people even right now eavesdropping on our conversation, and they say, Craig, I go to church, I drive to work every day, I live in a decent neighborhood, I take my kids to and from school, I've never seen any of this, I can't believe it happens in my neighborhood. How prevalent is this behavior nationally?
It's unfortunately extremely prevalent, and especially because of the rise of the internet, and it's so much easier now for sex traffickers, but even sex buyers themselves, to directly reach out and contact victims or potential victims. The statistics around sex trafficking are always a bit difficult because it's, of course, a crime that's happening in the shadows. So there's estimations, but none that I would really put my weight on. But, you know, I grew up in a small town where kids were loved, had intact families who talked to them about online safety, and know a person who was exploited online despite all of those safety nets that existed around them. So especially because of the internet, you know, every child and adults as well are vulnerable to this.
Yeah, I mean, how difficult is it for an individual who is not of majority that meets somebody in a online chat room, begins a dialogue, and then is being showered with promises? You know, if you're a teenager, what teenager likes their parents, right? Few really do. And all of a sudden, you've got somebody on the other end of the chat room that may be concealing their true identity, their age, et cetera, making promises about, you know, hey, come meet with me, we'll hang out, things of this sort. And suddenly that that chance meeting turns into what is essentially a kidnapping. And there can be a very rapid pace of seduction that takes place, again, through coercion and manipulation and promises of gifts and money and drugs, et cetera, and suddenly that young person that really doesn't have the ability to understand what's going on gets caught up in something and they become a victim. And I think you're right. The perpetrators of this, both in terms of those who engage in the pimp side of the equation as well as the Johns, that we really need to see stiffer, more serious penalties, like I've often said regarding the whole issue of illegal drug abuse here. Everybody wants to rail against the cartels, and yes, they are certainly guilty, but the biggest crime that they're guilty of finding a need and filling it. We wouldn't have an illegal drug problem in America if Americans weren't illegally taking drugs.
It's so true. The demand for sex trafficking, for buying people for sex, is disturbing. I think it's one of the reasons why people don't want to talk about this issue, is because if this issue's in our communities, it means there are people, typically men, in our communities who are engaged in this. And that's just a really disturbing but realistic thought that we need to address. And I would add, in addition to needing to raise penalties and enforcement against sex